Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David Latulipe. This week, conversations with Tony Award-winning director Frank Galati, who will be discussing his adaptation of the musical 1776, currently at ACT, an interview that I recorded earlier this week, that I'll admit right now is a total geek-out on my part, as that musical holds a very special place in my heart. I'll continue an exploration of the month-long Architecture in the City Festival currently underway, and a talk with Josh Kushner, who, with blind architect Chris Downey, is offering a workshop that helps owners and designers envision multi-sensory strategies to assist the visually challenged in successful navigation of buildings without exclusively relying on technology. Also, some clowning around, but not just in the sense of having fun. An actual clown, the amazing Jeff Hoyle, is here to talk about the return of his show Geezer, which is back at the Marsh. Plus, critic Peter Robinson shares memories of poet Seamus Heaney and broadcaster David Frost. Uh-oh, two Brits. Peter Robinson and Jeff Hoyle, make that three, David Frost remembrance. On a show with a big feature on American independence in 1776, will we have fireworks? Stay tuned. We are in our final 5 hours of our fall membership campaign here on KLW, and there are a number of interesting thank you gifts available to you should you choose to step up to support local public radio, including pairs of tickets to Jeff Hoyle's show, Geezer at the Marsh. You can have an option of lunch with Berkeley Symphony conductor Joanna Carnero for a donation, and I'm offering you your own private home concert or some party music. Yours truly on flute with either harp or guitar. Details about all those price points and levels of giving opportunity at our website, kalw.org, or by calling 800-525-9917. These particular gifts are limited in number and do vary in contribution level. So give the folks a call in our phone room. They're waiting for your call. 800, be the next person. 800-525-9917. Let's start by clowning around with Jeff Hoyle. British-born Jeff Hoyle trained with Marcel Marceau's teacher, Étienne Descroux, in Paris, developing his unique brand of physical comedy, a combination of court gesture, vaudevillian, English music hall comedian. Hoyle made his mark in the Bay Area as the Pickle Family Circus's beloved clown, Mr. Sniff. His award-winning shows have been seen in Paris, San Francisco, London, Berlin, around the world. Let's just say around the world. Hoyle created the original Zazu in the Broadway cast of The Lion King and has appeared in memorable productions with Bill Irwin for Maurice Sendak's adaptation of the children's opera Brundabar. Among many other credits, he's also appeared in the Berkeley Rep production of the Nathaniel Stuckey Lemony Snicket work, The Composer is Dead. What a treat to spend time with you, Jeff, even though we haven't started yet, so don't let me down.
No.
Jeff Hoyle, welcome.
Of course
welcome.
Not. Court gesture. That's a good, interesting way of putting it.
Ah, well, welcome.
Thank you.
We can't really call your show Geezer a one-man show because even though it's only you we see on stage, we see and hear your mother, your father, your wife, children, doctors, teachers, and a virtuosic turn as a bird, I must say, on the back of a chair. Although I think I do a better bird, at least audibly. We'll talk about that later.
All right.
But it's to a great extent autobiographical. Is it fair to call it a reflection on mortality?
Yes. Thank you. Good night. And very good. 800-525-9917.
My next guest is...
Let's get it over. Well, it's already 6 o'clock.
The show at the Marsh, Geezer, it's a comeback from... you did it back in 2011. Why is it back? Has it changed? Other than your aging, another 2 years?
Yes, I am now a little bit older, but not much. A couple of years. Well, no, it hasn't changed hugely. But there has been some updates. And I think it's gotten more streamlined. And I've found a lot more details within it. Just by doing it. Found a rhythm that's more...
you know, which I think holds people better. And I've been able to find a lot of very specific things in some of the characters, which is fun for me, and also more sound effects, which I really enjoy doing. You know, I mean, it's interesting. Yeah, you say it's not really a one-man show, but my great sort of love is the idea. I'm not sure about the fact, but the idea of the old Greek pantomimus, which was the guy who sort of brought the news to the center of the town or the village or whatever, and stood on the top of a barrel and sang the news and played all the characters. And it was sort of a one-man show. Where he did everything. It's a bit like Dario Fo, the famous Italian Nobel Prize winning for literature Italian playwright, who's now in his 80s, and used to do these solo pieces where he'd play all the different characters but make commentary. And so I think that one of the things that I'm trying to do is illuminate somewhat these characters and attempt to make commentary about what's going on with them and how it fits into the cultural morass that we're in nowadays.
Mm-hmm. Now, in part, the show is about your relationship with your father, who's now who you have now outlived by 7 years. Do you hear that clock ticking yourself now? I've come to the conclusion that at one point we become our mothers as we get older. But in your case, you see more of your father coming out in your messages?
I see both. I mean, I see a lot more of my father just in the sense that there's a nostalgia because he died when I was in my early 20s. And I haven't really been able to process that. My mother, God rest her soul, passed away this last January at the age of 96. Mm. You know, I was able to sort of process that because I was closer to my own, you know, end, dare I say it. You know, and so that kind of becomes more urgent. You kind of become more sympathetic to it when you're... One of the best gestures I do in the show when I'm leaving my father in the hospital and he's very, very sick, I'm about to leave him and I look at my watch because I have to catch the train back to London to walk on stage in a show I was performing at the time. And I always think, yeah, that's what we do when we're young. We just rush through that. We hurry by it. We've got other things to do. And you don't process it because it's not on your plate at that time when you're 20s. Mm. So I think that my dad is more present in that sense than my mother, who I've known as I've gotten older and older and older and older until I'm now 67.
What I'm assuming is advice from your father to work with your head rather than your hands comes from his life as a very hardworking typesetter in England. Now, tell us what you remember about his working life.
Not too much, because he went to the works, the printing company, which we would call the works. He was a union man. He was the father of the chapel. The typesetters' union was the Typographical Association, and it was, of course, a guild, a craft guild. I have clear memories of going to his works on a weekend when no one was there, and he would show me the linotype machine, the monotype machines, the big crashing huge presses that made those huge sounds. He'd show me this great chunk of lead hanging in a linotype machine where it gets made into molten lead and then goes through the fonts into the matrices to make the actual letters as the linotype is typed. None of this happens anymore because it's all digital and online, but it was an industrial process, and I think it was somewhat dangerous, and I sometimes wonder whether the lead that he was around was maybe influential in how he got sick. I do remember one kind of folkloric little number, which is that when he came back when I was really small from work, he would have this smell on him of type and ink, and his fingers were all inky, always black. And in his trouser turnips, or cuffs as you call them here, there would be lead spacers that had dropped from the case that it, while he was setting. And I used to fish them out of his trouser cuffs and play with them.
Hmm.
And they were lead, I guess.
Oh.
Which probably accounts for the fact that I'm completely nuts.
I was going to say, that might have explained a lot there.
Anyway, so those are the things about my dad's work.
So are you seeing yourself as your father when you reflect on your interactions with your own son?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Yeah, and my sons and my daughter see my father in me, I think, even though they never met him. But I think they understand what he must have been like. I have one actual audio recording, which is on quarter-inch Emmy tape of him, and it's a very poor quality recording, and I have to get it put onto a CD so I can give it to them. But yeah, they see. I mean, the thing about the end of the show when I become my dad and I put on that coat and that hat and the glasses, which is the only piece of costume in the show that I wear, that happened by accident. My son Dan, who's the other performer in the family, although everybody performs in our family, he was wearing this coat once in a show, and then somehow I inherited it because I'm following in my son's footsteps. And I put it on in front of my mirror, my work mirror, and then I put these glasses on that my daughter had that were part of a character that she does, a kind of a loopy character. And they looked just like my dad's bifocals. And then I had a cap that I bought in Donegal in Ireland, and I put that on. And I said, oh, good Lord, look, I am my dad. I got to use this.
Mm-hmm.
And it brought up a lot. It enabled me. Just those two, three little bits of costume.
I would love to spend an hour with you talking about some of your other work as well. I'm wondering, just to give people a taste of the show of Geezer, though, could you maybe, since we're talking about phone numbers today, 800-525-9917 to make a donation during this, our fall membership campaign, could you share with us a bit of your bit about a phone call to a death reservation agency?
Oh, yeah, let me see.
Thank you for calling DeathNet. Catholics, please press 1. Episcopalians, press 2. Fundamentalists, press 3, followed by your priority boarding code. All other denominations, press 8. Please enter your 5-digit reservation code now.
Beep, boop, bop, boop, beep.
Thank you. Please wait while we complete your reservation.
In paradisum, deducante angeli, in tuo adventu, suscipiante martires, et per...
Reservation is complete. You will die, Geoffrey Hoyle, on
Tuesday, June 30th, 2014,
at
8:30
a.m., you have received one promotional upgrade in your sleep. Thank you for calling DeathNet, and requiescat in pace.
Just an excerpt from Jeff Hoyle's show, Geezer. It's at the Marsh. Fantastic stuff. You'll see it's not just a mortality in the bad sense of what's going to happen. It really is an affirmation of life as you have lived it as well.
That's right. We should tell folks, could we have time to tell folks the dates and times?
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
It's at the Marsh, themarsh.org for tickets and information. It's running through October 26th, written and performed by Jeff Hoyle, developed with and directed by David Ford. Through October 26th, Wednesdays and Thursdays at 8, Saturdays at 5, themarsh.org. Jeff, please come back soon.
I'd love to.
I'm very pleased to speak with Tony Award-winning director Frank Galati, who was in town directing the 1969 Tony Award-winning musical 1776 in a new staging at ACT. Among Frank's many awards, which include being the recipient of 9 Joseph Jefferson Awards for his contributions to Chicago theater and being inducted into the Chicago Gay and Lesbian Hall of Fame in 2004, Frank won his Tony Award for Best Play for his adaptation of The Grapes of Wrath in 1990. He is a member of Steppenwolf Theater Company and professor of performance at Northwestern University. Frank Galati, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, 1776, I have to start with my own personal story about this musical. Mm-hmm. Well, when I was first involved as a middle school student back in Vernon, Connecticut, Vernon Center Middle School, band director Jim Kleiner programmed in band with me playing flute excerpts from 1776.
Wow.
Never heard of the show, never heard anything about the musical before, and boy, was I hooked not only on that, but on musicals as well. I even caught and audio taped off the television the time it was broadcast with the great William Daniels, Howard Da Silva, Ken Howard, first being introduced to those actors as well. So I'll spare you the fact that I can probably do the whole show verbatim.
Not at all.
Dialogue and songs, but boy, it really means a lot to me.
It's great to know that you were turned on by the music, that it was the score itself that you found so appealing, because it's really remarkable and unique in that appeal.
Mm-hmm. Now, this got me interested in history and just seeing these characters, and they really were characters, as more than just words in a history book. And it really ignited a whole sense of history for me as well.
Yeah, it's really remarkable the way in which the show compresses, edits, accelerates, intensifies, and really reaches tremendous theatrical force during the course of the 2 hours of the performance. It's all accurate, you know, in terms of the historical details.
Well, I think that might be a stretch.
Well, no, actually, it
there's some airbrushing going on. Let's put it that way.
Well, okay, there were 65 delegates to the Second Continental Congress, and there are only 27 in the cast of 1776. But
that's because of budgets. You can't hire 76 people to have on stage for that.
Well, plus the fact that the audience can't keep track of 65 delegates and all of their different points of view. So the compression is a theatrical license that in this case is very necessary and makes for a wonderful show.
Well, it's true that we learned that this was not an amicable bunch of founding fathers. They had, we were divided in more ways than North and South.
That's right.
Pro-independence, anti-independence.
That's
were
right.
We back then.
That's right. Well, at this time, 13 colonies in the Revolutionary America of 1776. And in the votes that are cast in the chamber of the Second Continental Congress, of the 13 colonies, 6 vote yea for independence, and 6 vote nay against independence, and 1 colony, New York, abstains.
Courteously.
Courteously, yes. Courteously. How courteous of New York to abstain. So split right down the middle.
And it is true that after the gentleman from New York abstained, I'm blanking on his name at the moment.
Hughes.
Hughes. When he learned...
Morris. Lewis Morris. Hughes is another representative at his table.
When he did learn that from General Washington's correspondence that his properties had been burned in Washington, yes. In New York. He said, what the hell, I'll sign it anyway.
That's right. Yes, he's a holdout because the New York delegates received very specific instructions from the legislature in New York that they were not to vote in favor of independence. But the last dispatch in the show that comes from General Washington indicates that Mr. Morris's estates have been confiscated, that some of his relatives have been arrested. His wife and family has moved to Connecticut, and his four sons have enlisted in the Continental Army. So he has nothing to lose. He's there in the room, and he commits himself, our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor, which was the phrase with which the Founding Fathers concluded the Declaration of Independence.
Indeed. So we do get a great history lesson out of this. Yeah. And even though it's inevitable that there are more than a handful of historic inaccuracies, for the sake of telling a good story,
yeah,
is the bottom line.
Yeah, right.
The central premise is that Adams is obnoxious and disliked, as we,
yes,
learned from the very beginning.
Yes.
And that comes from his own writing in 1822,
yes,
well after he was president, and reflecting back on his life. He was,
yes,
thinking, oh, I was obnoxious, and I was disliked and unrespected. And he was, in fact, one of the most respected members of the Congressional Assembly.
Oh, yes. He was deeply respected. He had enormous dignity and authority. He was revered as an attorney, a brilliant mind, litigious, but nevertheless scintillating and searing in his intellect, his capacity for analysis. And some of the, self-criticism, his acknowledging that he is obnoxious and disliked, is actually from his correspondence with Abigail, his wife. And I think one of the wonderful things that emerges in the show is how important these two women in the story are: Martha Jefferson, the wife of Thomas Jefferson, and Abigail Adams, the wife of John Adams. Both of these men could not have withstood the assault of this revolutionary turmoil without the compass of their love and affection and regard for their wives.
And there is wonderful correspondence between John and Abigail, of course.
Absolutely wonderful. And some of that correspondence is actually set to music in the show, just as, believe it or not, a number of the dispatches from General Washington in New York are the actual texts of the dispatches that Washington sent, and some of them are heartbreaking.
Mm, mm.
You know, he talks about the soldiers under his command being not more than lads, some of them not more than 14 years old, or old men,
right,
who were weary and exhausted and nevertheless had volunteered to fight for their new country.
And they had, in fact, Congress had sent out a team of representatives to see and assess the army, and they,
yes,
were saying what a ragtag bunch of people, but boy, when, yes, a turkey flew overhead,
right,
they first saw their first meal in a week,
yes,
they were spot on.
That's
so
right.
That's what led to a...
They could shoot.
That's for sure. Now, one of the other exaggerations, and it's, again, central to the drama, is the rivalry between John Dickinson of Pennsylvania and,
mm-hmm,
John Adams of Massachusetts.
Yes.
When, in fact, Dickinson had actually penned some of the injustices of George III. He wasn't,
yes,
totally just a loyalist, and he was a Quaker as well.
That's right. I think it's fascinating for audiences to observe in the sophisticated writing of this show what it was like in an age when extremely articulate, eloquent, and intelligent men who had very different points of view actually engaged in rhetorical combat. And what I think one is so astonished by is the fact that these men regarded one another, had deep respect for one another. As Benjamin Franklin says to John Adams at one point in the show, he says, you know, these men are not ribbon clerks to be bullied about just because you're cranky on a particular issue.
They're the cream of
these
their
are
colonies.
The cream of the intellectual crop in these colonies, and these men deserve respect. And so you'll see how conflicted Dickinson is about his alliance to Great Britain. He believes that the British culture is worth hanging on to, but he also very much believes in America as much as John Adams. And at the end, when Pennsylvania is defeated in its attempt to stop the Declaration of Independence, Dickinson says, I cannot in good conscience sign this document, but I am going to go and join the Continental Army and fight for this new America, even though I believe that these principles are not my own.
So this story, is, as well as the history lesson that we're getting, we're also getting a great deal of humor involved. Now,
yeah.
What's one of your favorite scenes in the show?
Well, one of the most delicious episodes involves the bringing to Philadelphia of Martha Jefferson. John Adams...
Which, I'm sorry, is a historic inaccuracy. But go on, go on.
Well, it may be a historic inaccuracy, but it is true that Jefferson was passionately in love with his wife.
There's no doubt about
that. Was very grieved to be separated from her and made frequent trips back to Virginia as much as he could to see her. I mean, the problem with stage space and time is that it's expensive to transform. So instead of following Thomas Jefferson to Monticello, which we could do in a film, we bring Martha Jefferson to Thomas Jefferson in Philadelphia. And we have a beautiful trio which features Martha Jefferson, who tells us all about her brilliant husband and one of his greatest talents, which is that he plays the violin.
One of the best numbers in the piece, yes.
Yes.
Indeed.
And of course, it's a little bit of a euphemism.
What's another scene of humor that you appreciate in the show?
Benjamin Franklin, who is well known for his sagacity and his wit, is forever making jokes at the expense of his rivals. He makes fun of his gout. He is randy in his appetites for women and good food and wine. So he's always making cracks about his own corporality, shall we say.
That I will give you as historical accuracy.
Yes, there's no doubt about that.
Well, it's interesting, the rivalry between Adams and Franklin as well. When Franklin is having his portrait painted for posterity, you know, being preserved for posterity, John is, well, I'm not going to appear in the history books at all. It's Franklin did this,
yes,
or Franklin
yes,
did that, or
yes,
Franklin did some yes, other damn thing.
Yes.
And one of my favorite lines, something along the lines of, Franklin smote the ground, and out came George Washington,
yeah, fully
grown and on his horse.
That's
Franklin
right, then
electrified him with his miraculous lightning rod, and the three of them, Washington, Franklin, and the horse, rode off into the history book. I'm paraphrasing, but
yes,
great.
But
Mike.
Very well.
And deciding what leads, of course, to song, deciding on what the national symbol of our
yes, country
is going to be.
Yes.
And three different versions of what that symbol should be.
Yes, yes. The eagle, the turkey, and the dove.
The
and
eagle
course,
being advocated by John Adams.
John Adams. The turkey from Benjamin Franklin.
Being a source of sustenance for our original settlers.
Absolutely. And a brave bird, not a coward. And not, as he accuses, the eagle of being the symbol of centuries of European power.
Imperialism.
Uh-huh. And so on.
And,
but, of course, Jefferson wants the dove, which is a very beautiful idea.
Which is too bad about that.
The symbol of peace.
I'm wondering about that for historical accuracy. I haven't researched that, whether it was true or not.
Well, I couldn't tell you whether or not it's true, but it certainly seems that it could be.
Yeah. And naturally, they break out into song about this. And one of the most clever lyrics in the show about once the eagle has been decided upon is the eagle is going to crack the shell of the egg that England laid.
Right, right.
It's just wonderful.
Isn't it wonderful? Writing. It's so clever. It's multi-edged. You know, in England laid an egg, which is itself, you know, kind of a joke on England. But the fact that a new nation is going to be born and that this nativity is going to take place in the chamber of the Second Continental Congress, and it becomes a kind of delivery theater.
In this congressional incubator.
In this congressional incubator. And that little eaglet is going to crack the shell of the egg that England laid. So it's delicious and witty and dead on, too.
Well, tell us, if you know, this anecdote about President Nixon's involvement in the film version of the
right.
show. Right.
Well, one of the most scorching and acerbic numbers in the show is Cool, Cool, Considerate Men, which is when Jefferson goes to Brunswick, New Jersey. I'm sorry, Adams goes to Brunswick, New Jersey, to have a look at the troops to confirm that they're not as in bad shape as General Washington says. And when he's gone, he leaves the chamber bereft of the liberals on his side of the aisle, and all the conservatives breathe a sigh of relief. And the opening phrase of the tune is, "Oh, say, do you see what I see? Congress sitting here in sweet serenity."
I could chair. The reason's clear. For the first time in a year, Adams isn't here.
Very good. I told you. You could handle a role in this show.
Mr. Casting Director, let me raise my hand.
Yes. No, but it's so marvelous that the heat has dissipated in this incubator in Philadelphia. It's become cool, and the cool, cool conservative men dance a gavotte, a minuet, to the right. Ever to the right,
never
to the left, always to the right. So it's a wonderful play on words. It's a wonderful choreographic event in the show. It's very colorful. It's very beautiful. And it is an absolute perfect satirical portrait of the conservative constituency of the Second Continental Congress. And back when the film was done in the early 70s, it was screened at the White House when Richard Nixon was president of the United States.
And friend of producer Jack Warner.
And after he saw Cool, Cool, Conservative Men, this send-up basically of the Republican conservative constituency that Nixon was so close to, he demanded that the number be cut from the film. And, you know, it was. The number was cut when the film was released, and it wasn't until years later, when Nixon was no longer in the White House, of course, that the full version of the show was edited and released.
And just one other historical accuracy I'm going to point out about that is when they were talking about the left and the right.
Yes.
The left and right as divisions of politics didn't even occur in our language until the French Revolution.
Uh-huh.
But it makes for a great number.
and also those aspects of combat were forming. So they might not have been named, but they were there in their infancy.
So every time this show seems to make the rounds, it resonates with contemporary history and politics. Yeah. Even composer Sherman Edwards, who passed away in 1981, mentioned that the show will be relevant as long as politicians blustered and young citizens were sent off to war, whether it was 1969 and the Vietnam War or the current impasse in Congress.
That's right.
And that wonderful Adams oft-quoted line, "I have come to the conclusion that one useless man is called a disgrace, that two become a law firm, and that three or more become a Congress.
Yes, absolutely.
And Sherman also said it's the same old salad with different dressing.
Yeah.
Talking with Frank Galati, who's directing the Tony Award-winning production 1776, now at ACT. Now, Frank, this is being billed as a new staging. Now, in opera, that can mean Don Giovanni in a leather jacket and motorcycle. Mm-hmm. What does that mean for something as iconic as our Founding Fathers and Philadelphia?
Well, it doesn't mean that we've placed this show in a different period, like 1876. And it doesn't mean that it's a revisionist view of either history or of the show. What it means is that in the 21st century, we can take a very fresh look through a very sharp, clear lens at an extraordinarily sophisticated and prescient piece of musical theater that first emerged in 1969 and had a brief but triumphant life. I mean, it wasn't such a brief life. It was a big hit on Broadway. It won the Tony Award for Best Musical, beating out both Promises, Promises and Hair.
In 1969.
Yeah. So to think that a musical play or a play with music, as the authors like to call it, could become a blockbuster hit and then a very successful film is a measure of how really smart and engaging and inspiring, really, this piece is, because it's full of ardor and passion. And I think the pride that we feel, those of us who are working on the show, is especially intense and gratifying because we feel that we are privileged to tell the story of the birth of our country, of the birth of our nation, and to tell it responsibly and with dignity and with good humor. And here we are giving, hopefully, a fresh interpretation. This is a somewhat streamlined text. The original show had lots of reprises and some scenes that were kind of circular. The Lees of Old Virginia is a number that is, in the original score, done twice, practically, the entire number. So we've made some edits. We've achieved a kind of velocity, a kind of headlong energy that we think is new and refreshing. And still, what has been said about it that makes it enduring remains the truth, which is that it ends unbelievably when you think this can never happen. At the 11th hour, the audience thinks, how in the world was independence ever declared by these 13 colonies unanimously? But at the 11th hour, by the skin of our teeth, we do create a new nation. And I don't know of another musical in all of musical theater history that ends with such a powerful action, not an anthem, not a big finale, not a big tap number, not even a big everything's coming up roses 11 o'clock kind of number. It ends with the signing of the Declaration of Independence by every one of the 13 representatives who are there. And when those bells ring and when those guys line up to sign that document, there ain't a dry eye in the house.
An iconic portrait, but not to be Debbie Downer, historically inaccurate.
You are such a downer.
And one other anecdote before I let you go. Richard Henry Lee, who brought forth the resolution to Philadelphia, yes. Who did he sire? Who was his son? Bum,
bum, bum, bum, Richard bum, Henry bum, Lee's bum, son was...
Who was Confederate General Robert E. Lee.
Yes.
Isn't that interesting?
Yes, it is. Yes.
Well, okay, so for historical accuracy, you may want to seek out a great read in the form of David McCullough's excellent 1776...
Spectacular book.
Or the
brilliant
Pulitzer
book.
Prize-winning John Adams, which is a page-turner.
Yes, absolutely.
And But for a fine evening of entertainment, I think you should seek out 1776 and Frank Galati's guiding hand as director of the tremendous ensemble ACT production of 1776 at ACT. Frank, thanks again for coming in today.
Thank you very much for having me.
You know, it's quite bizarre to think that here we are, plain midwives to an egg.
Egg? What egg?
America, the birth of a new nation. We're waiting for the chirp, chirp, chirp of an eaglet being born. Waiting for the chirp, chirp, chirp on this humid Monday morning in this congressional incubator. God knows the temperature's hot enough to hatch a stone, let alone an egg. We're waiting for the scratch, scratch, scratch of that tiny little fellow. Waiting for the egg to hatch on this humid Monday morning in this congressional incubator. God knows the temperature's hot enough to hatch a stone, but will it hatch an egg? The eagle's going to crack the shell of the egg that England laid. Yes, sir, we can tell, tell, tell on this humid Monday morning in this congressional incubator. And just as Tom here has written, though the shell may belong to Great Britain, the eagle inside belongs to us. And just as Tom here has written, we say to hell with Great Britain, the eagle inside belongs to us.
And the scratches you heard on that recording, not from the egg, but from my own personal vinyl collection, the original soundtrack of 1776. It's now being staged at ACT. Now through the 26th or so, information at act-sf.org. Now through, yes, information at act-sf. It looks like it's going through the 18th or so. It's got to be later. act-sf. David Latulippe, slightly addled, but with you here at KALW, moving from the earlier segment with Jeff Hoyle and the challenges of aging to the challenges of designing for the differently abled. I'm going to be talking now with Josh Kushner, an architect who works with the blind in mind. But one more invitation for you to join us here at KALW during our fall membership drive. If you're interested in tickets to Jeff's show for a $100 contribution, we'll give you a pair, 800-525-9917. The Architecture and the City Festival continues here in San Francisco, and one of the upcoming lectures is about acoustic wayfinding. Josh Kushner leads the Acoustics Theater and Audiovisual Consulting Practice in ARUP's San Francisco office. Josh has focused his career on increasing the value of his technical input through integrated design thinking, applied research, and harnessing advanced simulation tools. And he's established quite a track record of innovation and practical expertise in acoustic consulting and venue design. And he joins me now in studio. Hi, Josh.
Hi.
So what is acoustic wayfinding? I think we're all aware of mm-hmm. audible crosswalks and elevators, but what goes beyond that?
So it's a concept that myself and a collaborator, Chris Downey, came up with in the past 2 to 3 years. And it's effectively thinking about wayfinding in a system that you would find in buildings with signage. So it would tell you where to go and how to get there. And for folks that are blind or visually impaired, they depend on cues, mainly oral cues. And if you ever hear blind people giving directions to each other, they will give directions based on oral cues. So they'll say, if you've heard the fountain, then you've gone too far and go back. And if you're tapping your cane, you'll hear a glass canopy, and then that's the, you know, the pavilion, and take a right there. And so this is sort of the vocabulary for the blind to navigate buildings. And so our thought was, can we create a strategy in the design realm where just as you would create a system of signage, you would create a system of wayfinding for blind and visually impaired people.
Well, let's back up a moment to the use of the cane. Now, I always thought that just the use of the white cane was for tapping things that happen to be around you so you know that an object is in front of you. But the white cane is actually used for a lot more than that.
Right. So the cane's an extension of your hand. And so initially, it's really to feel around. But the once, you know, 80% of our of the sighted people's sensory input is visual, and that's how we respond. And once that's taken away, you're left with what you can feel tactily and what you hear mainly. And so what the cane tapping actually does is it starts to, when the sound changes, it starts to create markers in your mind. And so so just a little quick background. So I'm an acoustic consultant, and my collaborator is Chris Downey, who's an architect who's practicing for about 20 years and lost his sight. And so what we've been talking about is an idea that he first had, which was, you know, the facilities that the blind typically use over and over again, particularly public transit, but it could be anything. Once you go there once, you start to remember that the floor materials change and that you're at a certain point. Or even more subtly, that the acoustics of the room changes. So you're tapping your cane and you're creating an impulse of sound. And that impulse of sound actually has a different character if it's a large room, if it's a reverberant room, if it's a dead space. And so these things happen in buildings by happenstance, really. So you end up crossing from a different ceiling type or something like that, and you remember it, but it's not there purposefully. And so the concept that Chris and I have is to create a new vocabulary for architects and designers to think about accessibility and universal design, that you can actually create beacons and orientation and help people get from place to place by the acoustics of your building.
Hmm. Did you have any interaction with the blind or even considering your work to accommodate the blind before working with Chris Downey?
Not particularly, actually. My background has been in architectural acoustics and audio systems, and I happen to have met Chris once at an architect's office and then read about him about a year later, and I think in the article he was describing how the sound that the cane tapping makes is so useful. And so our group at AIRUP spends a lot of time on simulating designs of buildings before they're built and validating them and assessing them acoustically. And so the connection was kind of made in my mind to that there's a connection here that no one's really thought of yet. So 2 years ago, Chris and I put on an event for the Architecture in City Festival, kind of introducing this idea of acoustic wayfinding. And we brought together a number of architects in order to try to validate that it made sense and we could actually integrate it into the way architects think about buildings. Mm.
Do you find yourself acting as Chris's eyes, so to speak, when you're working with him? And has that maybe changed your perception of what it takes to deal with the issue of blindness in your everyday environment?
Well, I think the perspectives are that Chris understands the thinking of architects, being that he is one. And I've been bringing more of how do you actually affect architecture acoustically. So between the two of us, we've been playing off our strengths in thinking about how do we create something that the architectural community can embrace and start to actually implement.
Hmm. So this lecture on September 24th at AIRUP on Mission Street, tell us what happens during the lecture.
So the first one we did 2 years ago was we went to Montgomery BART, and we used the Montgomery BART station as just an example of bringing people through, closing their eyes, listening to a space, and thinking, if you were blind, how would you get through this space? And what would you change about the architecture to make it more useful? So this time we decided to take a more virtual approach, and we're simulating Terminal 1 at O'Hare. And what we're going to do is have people virtually come off of a plane and ask them to navigate O'Hare And so we've created a dynamic acoustic model of Terminal 1. We have the floor plans and elevations and acoustic finishes. And we're going to ask people just to simply use the bathroom and go to baggage claim.
Hmm.
And O'Hare is an interesting case because the gates are carpet and acoustic tile, and then the center concourse is a tall vaulted glass ceiling. So acoustically, they're different. And so there's some good aspects of that already. And so we're going to change the architecture during the modeling process and then trace how difficult it is for people just to do these simple tasks, and they'll have a controller to do it. And hopefully take that next step of getting an experience for architects to understand what the blind actually have to overcome to do simple tasks that we think, you know, we normally do.
So you'll be presenting that with Chris.
So we'll be doing that with Chris, and then we'll be taking that data to a conference in Boston in November, actually.
Very nice. It's part of the Architecture and the City Festival throughout the month of September. This particular event, Acoustic Wayfinding, with Joshua Kushner and Chris Downey, will be on September 24th from 6 to 8 p.m. More information about this and all of the City Festival events are at archandcity.org. Josh, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. And continuing things here on Open Air during this, our fall membership campaign, 800-525-9917, is our segment with Peter Robinson, who has a couple of remembrances to share with us today. Hey, Peter.
Hi, David. Good to be here. Good to be back. I've actually come back from South Utah covering the Documentary Film Festival. But while I've been gone, I noticed, sadly, two distinguished men of words, I think I'll use the expression, have passed away. And both of them, I think on different occasions, not only did I interview, but I think each made a significant contribution to, I want to say, Western culture. And the two people I refer to, both in very different fields, is first David Frost, the television interviewer, media personality. And then secondly, and I'll get to him in a second, is the great and distinguished Irish poet Seamus Heaney. With David, I would say that my history goes back to Cambridge University, and he was part of a group that formed a satirical society called the Footlights, and out of the Footlights came one of those famous shows called Beyond the Fringe with Peter Moore, Dudley Cook, Alan Bennett, and Jonathan Miller. And then he went on to become the anchorman of a show called That Was the Week That Was. And the reason I think it's important is that if we look at the 60s, we know very much about the protest movements, the drug culture. But in England, a separate entity was forming where these satirical comedians would effectively take on the government. And what we see historically is a change from people like Harold Macmillan, who became Super Mac, Alec Douglas Hume, to a more egalitarian and relaxed way at looking at politicians. And at the front of that was David Frost. And he would extend his sphere to celebrities. I remember one line that got him into a lot of trouble after the divorce between Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. He came up, he used to kiss her on the lips, but now it's all over. And, of course, that left people and the censors to divide what did the word over mean. Now, in this country, David Frost perhaps is best known for his interview with Richard Milhouse Nixon. And despite all the investigations of the Watergate hearings, he was the man who finally extracted some sense of remorse and some sense of apology from Richard Nixon, which I think speaks both to the power of the media and also to his gift as a journalist. And I think it's the difference between unveiling history, which is what he did with the Nixon interview, and opening up history. The concept of satire, which I think is very, very important in ages, particularly of repression, was defined by Alexander Pope, the 18th century poet, as true wit is nature to advantage dressed, what oft is thought, but they're so well expressed. And I think Frost's great gift was to express it and to de-imperialize a disappearing empire in the 1960s. Now, in a very different context, someone I felt in many ways very close to, both as a poet but also as a person, was Seamus Heaney. And I'd first met him when he was actually at Harvard, and he was teaching poetry. He was there for 8 years. He then went on to become the Oxford Chair of Poetry at Oxford. But the great thing about Seamus Heaney, and I think it's there both in his writing and in his personality, was the warmth of how he was with people and with words, and also his personal humility. He was a Nobel Literature Prize winner. He translated Beowulf, which actually became a bestseller in England. So now you've got an Anglo-Saxon poem suddenly read by everybody. But he would never leave behind the country that he treasured best and foremost, and that was Ireland. In fact, when offered the possibility of the British poet laureateship, he was quick to point out, "Be advised, my passport's green. No glass of ours was ever raised to toast the Queen." So he had a great classical education in Greek and Latin, but above all, he remembered Ireland. And if there's one poem that I'd like to best remember him by, a poem about memory, a poem where he's watching his father digging potatoes. "Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests snug as a gum. Under my window, a clean rasping sound. When the spade sinks into gravelly ground, my father digging, I look down." And he finishes the poem, "Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests, I'll dig with it." And dig indeed he did, and brought some sense of reconciliation at the time of the Irish Troubles. He died at the beginning, at the end of last month, beginning of September. He died, and only 2 days before, he was reading his own verse aloud. This was a living poet, and what I feel with him is the music continues on.
Indeed, considered the most important Irish poet since Yeats.
The most important Irish poet since Yeats, and definitely puts a capital I in Irish.
Well, thank you so much for both of those remembrances, Peter, and we'll catch up with you again very soon.
Good. Good to be here. Thank you.
David Latulippe in the concluding moments of Open Air, now with our station general manager, Matt.